This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place with your host, Craig Danieloff.
The movie A Complete Unknown starts and ends with Bob Dylan and Woody Guthrie in the Greystone Park Psychiatric Hospital in Morris Plains, New Jersey. Today, on Not Completely Unknown, we learn more about Dylan's time there with Woody from two people who were directly involved, Woody's daughter Nora Guthrie and a friend named Bonnie Beecher, who was later known as Johanna Romney. Beecher's name will be familiar to Dylan fans because the Minnesota Hotel tape, also known as the Beecher tape, was made in her apartment by Tony Glover in December 1961. So she was in fact Bob's friend from the time period just before he came to New York. She is also, not incidentally, allegedly the original girl from the North Country and the subject of another early Dylan song called Bunny, Why'd You Cut My Hair, which can be found on those Minnesota hotel tapes.
Bunny, why'd you cut my hair? Bunny, why'd you cut my hair? Bunny, why'd you cut my hair? Now I can't go nowhere.
We'll hear more about the hospital, Woody's time there, and the interactions between Bob and Woody. It's a great dose of reality to put context around and expand our understanding of the real events and relationship that inspired those great scenes in the movie. These are fascinating insights into the situation at Greystone with Woody and Bob. Both of these interviews were done about 6 years ago by the Greystone Park Psychiatric Hospital Oral History Project, by Stephanie Kipp. There is a second interview with Johanna here too. It's shorter and tells much the same story, but it's from about 25 years earlier, so it's told with a little more excitement and it's fun to hear. That version is from an interview originally done by Marcus Whitman. Check the show notes for links to an amazing documentary on YouTube about Guthrie and Greystone Park, with beautiful images of the place before it was torn down. Now, let's start with Nora Guthrie.
So the specific circumstances was one day he was found hitchhiking in New Jersey, and he was picked up for vagrancy by the police and said that he was drunk, etc. And they called the office of the man who was my father's manager at the time, and he said, he's not drunk, he's sick. And they took him to Greystone Hospital for observation. And that's how he landed there in the first place and then ended up spending many, many years there.
So then what happened after he arrived? How did the staff, professional staff and otherwise, regard him and work with him?
Well, he was just a typical patient. He wasn't quote-unquote Woody Guthrie at the time. He was considered a kind of drunken guy they found on the New Jersey Turnpike. And I remember reading some of the original transcripts from his admittance. And it's just very typical, like found, you know, incoherent or possibly this interview. He says this. He says his name is Woody Guthrie and that he's a folk singer, but we don't know whether to believe him because he could be schizophrenic. And it just kind of all this like early interview kind of stuff they do in the entrance place of the hospital. And also, again, a lot of confusion about what he was saying and where to put him. And again, it's a psychiatric hospital. You have to remember this. And so everything that's coming out of his mouth when he says that he's a writer, they're going, yeah, yeah. Oh, I think in the entrance papers, it says that he has illusions of grandeur, actually, in the papers. So it was kind of messed up, you know. And then they began doing a number of different kinds of tests, etc. And
so when did it become evident that he was Woody Guthrie and had an impressive set of skills?
Well, even, you know, it became the manager went and cleared things up and said he actually is a writer. At that point, he wasn't really as well known as a folk singer writer, as well as he had published Bound for Glory, his autobiography, in 1943. And that was a kind of a big hit for him, so to speak. And I don't mean that it sold a lot of books, but it was well received by the critics and by other writers as being a very novel piece of writing for the time. It kind of predated Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And there's been, you know, a lot of thoughts that Kerouac, in reading Bound for Glory, kind of inspired him to write On the Road. To what extent that's true or not, I don't know, but they're very similar in their styles of writing. And so, unless you happen to have read, and you were in that, you know, reading the New York Times book review, he was kind of still a drunk guy found on the New Jersey Turnpike, you know. So it wasn't until, I remember my brother Arlo tells a very funny story about another inmate at the hospital coming up to him and saying, oh, you're Woody Guthrie, I loved your book. And Woody answers, oh, you read my book? He said, no, I ate your book. So that's as famous as we were at the time. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that is the story that goes around in the family.
Okay.
And later on, Woody, he did stay there for a good number of years, and part of your answer in that is that as he was acknowledged as a folk singer later on, people would start bringing records to the hospital and saying, oh yeah, this is him on record. And they went, oh, they would play it on the loudspeakers in his ward. So no one had researched really what were those years like in the hospitals. So that was a total mind blower for me to find all these writings that had happened. And what were they about? They were about nurses in the hospital. They were about patients in the hospital. They were about his day, what he did in the day. He talks about helping to clean up the ward. Because again, he's not a psychiatric patient. He was put into Greystone because there was no place else for him to go. We can talk more about that later. But so he's writing about, I tried to help serve all the trays of food when they put out. I tried to help sweep up. I loaded up the chairs. I piled them up in the rec room. So he's describing his daily life, trying to keep himself busy and volunteering for lots of different things in the hospital. So what he left us in his writings from the hospital is very, very interesting and significant, and hasn't been kind of fully exposed as yet. A lot of writings about lyrics about spirituality, about understanding what illness is, a coming death might be like, what life is like. So it kind of gets really interesting, actually. Yeah. After a few times, again, as my father was getting worse, he was in a big ward with about, I don't know, 30 other patients. And he was at the end of the ward, so we had to walk through this whole psychiatric ward to get to him. And it was really scary. And I didn't like, it was just horrible. I didn't like it at all. And I remember this feeling of hiding behind my mother's skirt, like we were three ducks in a row, walking down, like, looking, you know, hoping people jumping around or making strange sounds. Very scary place, actually. And then she said, well, let's all meet outside. So there was a big tree right outside the ward, and it was a weeping beech tree, something like that. And my father called it the Magic-y tree. There's the ending instead of the magic tree. It was the Magic-y tree. And we would play under that, like monkeys climbing all over the tree. And my father would come out and my mother would make a picnic. And we would play around the tree and goof around. So that was better. We didn't have to be in the ward. People started coming out to our house, a lot of musicians and his friends. They would call it a hootenanny at the time. And they would come out and bring their instruments and play music for him all day with him.
Did he appreciate that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really liked that.
And did they play his music or other music?
Well, the joke was that that sometimes the younger ones would come and say, Woody Guthrie, I have a new song. Would you like to hear it? And he'd go, no. Not really. So he loved when people played his songs. I mean, at that point, because of Dylan, a lot of his songs started to get more well-known. Previously, in the small folk circle, which was like 30 people in New York or whatever, but through Dylan, you know, songs like Pastures of Plenty and 1930 Massacre, Hard Travelin', all the Dust Bowl songs, the young people started singing them. So you would get young people coming to the house and saying, I want to be a songwriter just like you. You want to hear my new song? And he'd go, no. And even Dylan says he called himself a Woody Guthrie jukebox. He said that's what Woody wanted to hear. He wanted to hear all the young people singing his songs, which, of course, when you think about it, when you're going, you want to make sure that someone knows what you've done with your life. So it was very deeply meaningful to him to have young people singing Pastures of Plenty, Grand Coulee Dam, all these songs that he had spent his life writing and actually hadn't even recorded or released a lot of them up at that point in the 50s and early 60s. The Ash recordings didn't come out until later. The only records that were out were Dust Bowl Ballads, which was 11 songs. And, you know, and one or two other songs that people had heard in concert or on radio. But the bulk of his material wasn't released until the 60s already, when Smithsonian Folkways took over.
Did he ever, when other people were playing his music, like correct them or stop them, saying it's not how it should be?
Arlo. Arlo tells a couple of funny stories how he learned some of the songs, and my father would say, well, there's more to it than that. And that's one of Arlo's best stories, is with This Land Is Your Land. He learned the first three verses, and then my father said, well, there's three more that they don't teach you in school. So he taught them the last three verses of that, which is the way Arlo sang it from that day on. You know, include some of the verses about no trespassing, Freedom Highway, things like that, and the relief offices by the shadow of the steeple. I saw my people by the relief office. I stood there wondering, is this land made for you and me? So Arlo was very excited to be one of the first people to bring all of the verses to light. I remember one very moving anecdote that Dylan talks about. When he would light his cigarette, he had a lighter that some fans from England had sent. And him watching him try to light the cigarette is like that. When you have Huntington's, it's really hard. And Bob would tell the other kids, they would try to help, and he goes, oh, he wants the respect. I can do this. He didn't want to be pitied, you know. So everyone, you know, they would back off, and Dylan would say, no, don't try to light his cigarette. He can do it. You know, you just sit there and wait for him to do it. The very end, Dylan really kind of got it. You know, he really got that Woody was in a situation where he didn't want to lose respect. He didn't want people having pity on him. And he wanted to maintain his dignity. So whatever, if his lighter went like this a few times, you just had to sit and watch.
And here is Jehanara Romney, the former Bonnie Beecher.
Could you tell us a little bit about prior to your visit to Woody Guthrie, how did you know Bob Dylan?
Oh, well, I'm originally from Minnesota and was living still in Minnesota at that time. And I went to high school at the University High School on campus. And there was one single coffee house on the university campus. And Bobby used to come down from Hibbing and go hang out there and play music not officially, but I would leave for my lunch hour or after school. I would go hang out at the coffee house. And so we met at that coffee house when I was in high school. And then we both, the following few years, went to the University of Minnesota and got to know each other better there when we were both living in Minneapolis.
What were you studying?
I was studying theater arts. And he was studying music.
Okay. And you both ended up going into that?
Yeah.
Okay. So how did you end up in the New York area that you two connected to go out to Greystone?
In high school, I had a remarkable theater arts teacher named Karen Osborne. And when I graduated from high school, she and I became roommates and lived on campus. And she took... When I was in high school, I would go as part of her group to visit New York once a year with my high school class and go to theater things. And then when I was out of high school, I would be an adult chaperone.
Yeah, yeah.
For the then high school students. And so we were in New York for several days, and I would look up Bobby, who was at that point living there.
Okay, and then... How did it come to pass that he invited you to come along with him?
Well, we were in touch with each other after he moved to New York, mm-hmm. in the heaven knows when, early 60s. I graduated from high school in 59, so probably early 60s. And he was reporting back that he, who had been trying to figure out how to actually meet Woody Guthrie, had succeeded and become a regular visitor, and people in Minneapolis, this is my impression of what happened. People in Minneapolis did not really believe that that was true. So when I was in New York and Bob and I checked in with each other, I think he wanted me to witness him having access to Woody in the hospital. So he brought me with him, I think, so that I could go back and tell all of our friends. Now, if you're interviewing Dylan, he may tell it different. That was my impression at the time.
Okay, okay. Did he describe the hospital to you before you went there?
My memory is very faded on this. He described that he had gone there several times and be unable to get in, and that it was like a fortress castle. Mm-hmm. And I think that at one point he was there when somebody from his family came and they walked in with him. They walked him in and made it. Now, that is what I remember. And that there were family members that visited, and they facilitated Bob being on the guest list. And then he was on the guest list, so that when I arrived, I was then Dylan's guest. And they let me in on his say-so. When we visited, there was nobody else visiting Woody except Bobby and I that
okay.
day.
And even with his pre-approval... What sort of procedure did you have to go through to actually get in?
What I mostly remember is I was expecting to visit a hospital, and it felt like I was visiting a jail, and because there was like somebody at a desk, and just talking to them, but then there was a clanging gate door that was like a sliding crash, and this is the one memory I'm absolutely sure of, and it was very intimidating and scary, and I felt like I was entering a prison rather than a hospital. And where I went in, what was clearly something like a day room, I was under the impression that I was visiting a hospital where Woody was an ambulatory patient, and so therefore he was put with people with mental problems because they were ambulatory and Woody didn't need to be staying in a bed. That's what I thought. I understand now that the whole hospital was a psychiatric hospital. But this was a day room, and there were tables, and people were wandering around and sitting at tables talking with visitors. It was probably a visiting room. And Woody and Bob and I were at a table to ourselves. And at one point, Bob brought his guitar and played Woody some songs, some of Dylan's versions of Woody's songs, which was very pleasing to Woody. And Woody had a Huntington's disease, Huntington's chorea or cholera, and had a lack of control of his physical body. But he still had some control, you know. And at one point, he wanted to play a song. And Bob offered his guitar, and Woody said, "I want my guitar." So one of my memories is that they called a nurse over who was, monitoring the room, and asked for her to please go get Woody's guitar. And I remember her saying, in a voice as though you were talking to a child, "Oh, Woody, do you play music?" I just went, "Oh my God, they have no idea who this man is." She was nice, but it was like, I realized that he was in a place where he was just another guy that couldn't control his body and didn't have any history to them. So she did find his guitar, and she brought him his guitar, and he wanted to play a song for us. And he played a song for us with some physical difficulty, but still. And what I think the song was "Hard Traveling." And I've been doing some hard traveling, I thought, And there's so many Woody Guthrie songs that I learned in my life, but I hope my memory is right. I believe that's the one song he played for us, and he was able to do it with some physical difficulty. And I had some idea of who Woody Guthrie was at that point, and I was just paralyzed with awe that I was getting to be present for that. And we did spend quite a while together in that room. It wasn't just a brief visit. We was there probably a couple of hours. And I needed to work through Woody's initial impression of me, which Dylan fiendishly introduced me to Woody by saying, "This is my friend Bonnie, and she's a fan of Josh White." And I was a fan of Josh White. I liked the blues. I was, a Minnesota teenager who was scrambling to try to find music that wasn't easily available to me. However, Josh White had been a witness in the HUAC hearings for "Are You a Communist or Not?" And Woody had been snagged with that a little bit. And the fact that I was a fan of Josh White was not a great way to introduce me to Woody Guthrie. And I I was spent the rest of my time trying to overcome that impression, which I did. He was very, lovely to us, and I think his guitar still had a message on it that said, "This machine kills fascists," or I think that was the message. And there was people who were wandering around the room or also receiving visits who were clearly in another realm mentally. And I remember one in particular that seemed to know that Woody at least had some, or maybe knew who Dylan was, I don't know, kept coming up to the table and saying, "I understand you've been to Greenwich Village." And he kept saying that. He'd come over like every 10 minutes, "Tell me about Greenwich Village." And so finally Dylan did tell him a little bit about Greenwich Village. And we didn't encounter anyone else who was there, but there was probably 30 people in the visiting room and other visitors.
Were you able to hear the conversation, or was it really noisy in there?
I don't remember it being noisy. It was quite a spacious room. Uh-huh. And there was a place where if it wasn't a balcony, at least there were windows, and people were sitting over by the windows mostly. And our table was by itself, and I was able to hear, but not other people's conversations.
Did you get a sense that Woody appreciated Dylan's rendition of his music?
Very much. They were good friends by the time I got there. He was very glad to see Bobby. And Bob had been a regular visitor once he was allowed to visit. He had evidently been there a lot. And the people who worked at the registration desk, and not the nurses, but the nurse that brought us the guitar, knew who Dylan was, or knew him as a visitor, as a welcome visitor of Woody's. And so did this one guy who wanted to know about Greenwich Village.
What about smoking? Because Nora Guthrie tells a sweet story about Woody's inability to really control all of his motions. Mm-hmm. And other people sometimes, when he would try to smoke, would immediately rush over. And in Nora's words, Dylan got it, that Woody needed to try as best he can to smoke, you know, light his cigarette, even if it took him a few attempts. Do you remember smoking at all?
When you tell me this story, that I feel like I encountered something like that.
Okay.
But I can't remember it clearly. Woody had a hard time. We must have had a snack or a tea or something, because it was hard for him to control feeding himself. I don't know what it was, if we had crackers or if it was just a Coke or something. But I think I may remember that, but... Mm-hmm. This was a long time ago.
I'm impressed by your memory.
Well, it was Woody Guthrie. You know, it's like, this is not a non thing. This was when I talk to kids at camp, and they ask the staff people to interview, and they say, what's the most exciting thing that ever happened to you in your life? And I've known a lot of really exciting, interesting people, and I always say, I spent an afternoon with Woody Guthrie.
All right. That's great. Do you remember your goodbyes to him?
No, I don't remember the goodbyes. I remember the door crashing again behind us, and what a loud noise it made, and how prison-like it was, and scary.
Do you recall when you all you traveled there by train, maybe? I think that's the only way you might have
gotten. I don't know. I remember talking to Bobby about how we were going to get there.
Right.
And he, there was possibly, evidently there's some people that used to visit Woody or knew he was there,
Gleasons,
that lived in the nearby, maybe we could drive in from with them, but we didn't. And then were we going to take a bus or a train? And I think we took public transportation of some kind, but honestly, I have no direct memory of getting there. I remember the castle-like building that we had to go through, talking to someone before we came behind the prison sliding metal door that made a loud noise, and I wonder how we got there. No idea. But I believe we didn't ride with someone, I believe, and I could be wrong.
Okay. Do you recollect your thoughts or feelings after you had visited him, right after? I mean, did you two talk when you were going back to the city about how the visit had gone, or?
Well, I don't know. Bob and I were friends, so we just carried on our life's conversation. Let's see. I can't directly remember. This had a great impact on me, and I was very, I was overwhelmed with joy to, you know, as a person, a teenager in Minnesota who was looking for a certain kind of music that was very hard to find, and I knew who Woody Guthrie was, and I probably am the only one of my friends that did, except for Dylan and our mutual friends, and so I was very touched, and so I would have talked to Bobby about that, and I probably would have talked to him about, oh yes, I'll go back and tell, you know, Dave Whitaker and Red Nelson and all our friends back in Minnesota.
Okay.
Yeah.
So one last question: how was this experience of us chatting about your trip to Greystone and seeing Woody Guthrie? How has that been for you to recollect memories of this iconic place and person that was there?
I'm glad that every aspect of Woody Guthrie's life and who he was to humanity is being looked at, and people are learning more about it.
In this first part of the older interview, Jahanara talks about Bob coming back from New York before she went with him to Greystone.
Suddenly, he'd been gone for a couple months. He came back talking with an Oklahoma accent, real thick, and wearing a cowboy hat and boots. And he was into Woody Guthrie in a big way, a really big way. And I thought it was very silly because, you know, here you are, you're a Minnesota boy, you're trying to pretend you're something you're not. But he really immersed himself in Woody Guthrie and kind of absorbed Woody's every motion and breathed Woody. And if Dylan had a few too many drinks, I'm not kidding. I mean, you had to call him Woody or he wouldn't answer. No jive. And at the time, it seemed ludicrous and pretentious and foolish to me. And now I look at it and I think this is a man who was absorbing his master's essence and who did indeed absorb it and then who came out the top as a greater Bob Dylan, you know, having really just lived and breathed this guy. He was not afraid to look like a jerk.
And here, from that same 1990s interview, she recalls later going to New York and visiting Woody Guthrie with Bob Dylan.
And so he had actually met Woody Guthrie and got to know him and became one of the people on his visitor list. When I went out to New York, Dylan took me to meet Woody Guthrie in the Greystone Hospital. We went to the hospital, and we went into the insane asylum ward of the hospital because Woody had Huntington's cholera, which made him spasm. He had physical spasms. But his mind was pretty intact, and he didn't need to be bedridden in the hospital. So the only area of the hospital where you could walk around, there was a day room and, you know, a social place where you could be free but still be hospitalized, was in the place where crazy people were. So that's where they had Woody Guthrie. And Dylan and I went in. Dylan brought his guitar. Woody was there, and he looked just exactly like he looks in all his pictures, you know. And I remember being awestruck. And there was a big gate that it was like a jail. And it was a bit, you know, the gate would roll across on a track and clang shut. And it would roll open. Like, you couldn't get in there without standing. We had to stand for 15 or 20 minutes and then sign our signatures. And they looked up Dylan's name on the list. It was really hard to get in there. It was kind of scary once I was in there with these banging doors.
Did Woody seem to enjoy Dylan?
Oh, yeah. They were very good friends. Mm-hmm. Woody loved Dylan. Dylan was doing his songs. Woody was... I knew who he was because I studied that kind of music, but people didn't generally know who Woody Guthrie was then. This Land Is Your Land was not on everybody's song list, and he was not world famous. And Dylan was singing his music and carrying his music on, and carrying on not just Woody's songs, but carrying on the genre of music. And Woody wrote a bunch of talking, you know, talking fishermen, talking... whatever, and Dylan was starting to pick up the same thing, and like he wrote Talking Hugh Brown and stuff about his life, but Woody really appreciated that Dylan was carrying on his own music and that kind of music in the world.
Did you enjoy this show? Then please rate this podcast and leave a review. It really helps. Also, sign up for 7 Days, our free weekly newsletter that puts all the top Bob Dylan news and links into your inbox every Sunday. Use the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening.